Hello and welcome to another episode of Cloud Security Podcast. We are continuing with our Azure Security Month, and today we are talking about Azure Kubernetes Service, or AKS. Yeah, we had Jimmy Mester from KSOC, and we spoke about why are people using Kubernetes in the first place in Azure, and we spoke about Windows containers, Linux containers. I did not even know there were Windows containers being used. I still don't know the reason why people use Windows containers. Maybe there are specific applications. And then I met two more people who spoke about Windows containers. So this was really eye-opening for me. And I think it'll be eye-opening for yourself as well on to understand what's the shared responsibility that Azure kind of takes away from you when you're trying to secure a Kubernetes cluster in a Azure managed space. So this was really interesting from that perspective. If you are someone who's trying to build up your knowledge on building applications securely in an Azure Kubernetes AKS kind of service with multiple clusters, this is the episode for you. And if you know someone else who probably needs some help, feel free to share this episode with them. And while you're there, if you can help us by leaving us a review or a rating, that would be really appreciated. If you have left us one in the last week, thank you so much for doing that. I really appreciate it. It really helps us find more people that we can help out and help learn cloud security together, cloud native security together as well. So that's been really awesome for me so far. So I look forward to helping out more people and maybe a lot more interaction with yourself. There were a lot of resources shared during the episode. So definitely check out the show notes either on this podcast show note episode, or you can head to www.cloudsecuritypodcast.tv for the links that you can find to secure a Kubernetes environment. That's pretty much it for this episode. I'll see you next weekend for the next Azure Security episode, and take care and talk to you soon. Peace.
As companies expand to the cloud, asset visibility worsens. The Jupyter One Cyber Asset Management Platform helps you get it back. Jupyter One provides context, understanding, and visibility into your entire cyber asset attack surface with over 150 integrations, including AWS, Google Cloud, Azure, and more. Jupyter One helps you answer complex security and infrastructure questions, understand the contextual relationships between assets, and build the foundation for your security program. Try it for yourself. Get started with your free Jupyter One account today.
To start off with, for people who may not know Jimmy, how did you get to where you are today, and what's your story, man?
Yeah, I actually have a degree in cybersecurity, and I can't remember the exact title. So this was I graduated from a school called Penn State, and I was meandering through college. I knew I was into computer science and all things computers, but this new degree sponsored by the National Security Agency in the US, the NSA, came out, and I thought it sounded really cool to hack computers. And it was really early days. This is 15 years ago. And I just got super into it through school, which is kind of not the traditional path. And I did some international trips working on kind of systems in Africa and Grenada. And I eventually landed at a company called Agilent Technologies, which was a big spinoff of HP, doing application security. And I took an abandoned AppSec program. I was given the keys to the data center and basically brought my crash cart over and plugged in a WAF and figured out how to do AppSec. I took down prod a bunch of times in the process. And that's kind of where it all went, and went on to some consulting engagements. And ultimately, I went into Kubernetes, specifically the company I was at, Invoca, out of Santa Barbara. We decided to adopt it at about 0.8 in production, which was still like a side project at the time. And I was responsible for compliance, like literally PCI and HIPAA and SOC 2 and like all these other things. And it was very eye-opening to introduce Kubernetes at that time, pre-RBAC, pre-anything. And yeah. I just loved it. Yeah. So that was like 5.5 years ago or something. And I'm still just deeper than ever into Kubernetes. And here we are today.
Wow. People who are probably tuning in, listening to Azure, thinking about Azure Kubernetes security, just to level the playing field for everyone, what is Kubernetes as well?
There's like the philosophical answer and then the like technology. And Kubernetes by definition came from Google out of their Borg project. And that's less exciting than what it kind of has evolved to be. And really, it's like, it's a community first almost. It's very rare to have infrastructure tools have such a following and such a passionate community around the developer ergonomics and all of these different things that make up this way we deploy software. And I kind of think of Kubernetes as that, like more than just a series of pods and sitting on nodes with a control plane. Like we can talk about that, but Kubernetes is this special thing that happened. It has its own like two part like documentary, which no infrastructure in the world had different. So I see Kubernetes as like this culmination of like the technology side of DevOps almost, and giving you ways to run applications and ship code faster, more reliably, and with better tooling. So that's what I think it is, at least.
I did not realize there was a two-part documentary on Kubernetes as well.
Yeah, it was released a couple months ago. It's interviews with all the originals from Google, Joe Beta, and like Chris Anichek's in there from the CNCF. It's a really well done documentary on the Kubernetes project.
I'm going to check that out as well. I'm going to find a link and put it in the show notes. So coming from point eight all the way to Azure AKS, for people who are listening into Azure AKS now, how different was point eight and what's Azure AKS? How different is that to the original Kubernetes, I guess?
Managed Kubernetes was like a natural progression and land grab by the different cloud providers, GCP, AWS, and Azure. I forget the exact, I feel like Azure was last. Don't quote me on that, but like they were kind of close within the same year where everybody's like, we need a managed version. Azure as a public cloud has really taken off. Like I see a lot of Azure implementations just due to places being historically Microsoft shops, and like Azure is a natural fit for a lot of their workloads and Active Directory and things that have powered enterprise for a long time. So it was only a matter of time before Azure had a like mature offering for Kubernetes. And the evolution really was roll your own cluster, DIY or Kubernetes the hard way, whatever you want to call it, is hard. You're using tools that help you bootstrap virtual machines. There's passing of, you know, certificates, there's installing different components, there's maintaining those components, upgrade paths, security issues. Like the control plane for Kubernetes is complicated and it has a lot of levers and knobs that if you don't get it, you're either going to get hacked or have downtime or both. And I think Azure saw this opportunity to have a managed service for people who want to run containers, and it abstracts away the control plane. So all of the things that are a pain or a headache or really don't add value to your company, they try to abstract away and give you configuration through their cloud APIs, similar to EKS and GKE, to basically run Kubernetes as simplistically as possible. And AKS does a fine job at that. There's opinions that are very strong between different providers, but they're all very GA, so, you know, full-featured solutions to abstract away the Kubernetes control plane.
So it's funny because maybe this could be really one of the reasons why Azure AKS may have been the last, if it was the last one. Because I think when I think about containers, I'm not really thinking Windows containers, even though they do exist. And we were talking about this offline, that I am having conversations with people where they're using Windows containers. Like that's become a thing. Because in my mind, like Kubernetes, container orchestration, and then that's Linux. That's not Windows. You're also starting to see Windows containers appear more often.
I don't think it's at like any sort of critical mass for us personally and what we do at KSOC, but the offering is there. And it's really around like Windows Server. GK clearly supports Windows containers, and we're not discounting that, but like GKE does too. And you have to run special nodes. You necessarily just throw this Windows Server kind of Windows container inside of Kubernetes and it knows exactly what to do. There's a support story there. And then like the security story is I have GKE's Windows offering, and they're like, if you're running this in a multi-tenant sort of hostile environment, beware of container breakout, because there's certainly, you should be spinning up another cluster if you have this sort of true multi-tenant need. There's definitely process isolation and all the things you would expect out of containers, but I think there are some unknowns and some boundaries that Windows containers may not have. And to be honest, I will not claim to be the bona fide Windows container expert. Maybe that's the next podcast.
I definitely have someone in mind for that kind of episode as well. I definitely find that fascinating as to how people would do Windows container and then do that in Kubernetes, but then at the same time, scale it up as well. So, I mean, I'm not saying that Windows operating systems cannot be scaled. They can be. Clearly, Azure is in the space, being the second largest cloud provider. I hear a lot of examples about GKE production deployments, AWS Kubernetes deployments, having a lot of production deployments as well. I'm sure people use AKS in production. Are there any well-known examples maybe that you can share?
Without naming names, but there's actually two very large kind of healthcare providers, sort of Azure and healthcare, and Azure and name your three-letter agency, like government agency. They tend to lean towards Azure for some pieces of their cloud story. So we see these healthcare kind of huge multi-chain sort of, it's hospitals, it's everything, highly regulated. They tend to lean towards Azure and they're modernizing the stack. I loathe the phrase digital transformation, but that's what they're doing. They're taking pen and paper type things and moving it into the cloud, and like their systems are becoming more modern and they're using AKS to do that in a big way in production. Absolutely.
Wow.
So yeah.
Healthcare and compliance. I think that those two things I didn't, and going that with Kubernetes is not something that I thought of, but then again, you started your career in compliance, driving compliance in a Kubernetes environment as well. So that's a testament to that as well. So maybe another thing to unpack would just be we spoke about self-hosted versus managed. In an Azure AKS environment, what are we really, there's a whole shared responsibility that's really slapped on people, where anyone who's listening in and they have been basically given, hey, we are deploying an application in AKS. What are some of the things that are taken care of by Azure? And what are some of where's the line drawn where someone who's listening in needs to be taking care and taking responsibility for securing Azure versus something that would be taken care of by Azure?
Shared responsibility, that's always a fun topic. So Azure's going, just like AWS, is going to take care of the underlying kind of compute infrastructure. Anything that they have control of, you know, backbone routing stuff, like key material storage in their kind of KMS offerings, things of that nature where you really don't have a choice to configure, they're going to be responsible for and have compliance and checkboxes around, you know, attestations that other people looked at that system and they made sure it's secure. So the thing with AKS, you know, specifically is once you get a node pool going and you set up your AKS environment, like you're kind of on your own. Every workload you spin up is yours. Even the maintenance of the nodes, like making sure that they're locked down appropriately and not open to the internet, and all the kind of hygiene stuff we've seen with just regular old virtual machines, networking, it's up to you. Like you can use AKS in a very hardened, almost air-gapped sort of way, or you could just leave it open and you could get hacked sideways within 5 minutes, and it's everywhere in between. So some of the things that Microsoft Azure does offer, I think that other clouds have some flavor of, but I really like their kind of security baseline. Like they have these like security benchmarks that they publish, and they're pretty clear about the shared responsibility model for Azure and AKS. And you could read through this list. It's funny because they call out things very specifically. Is this my responsibility or yours? And if you scroll down, there's a big block that says responsibility customer. And you go down the list and most of it is your responsibility still. And I think that's where the complication with Kubernetes security comes in, whether it's AKS or doing it yourself. So it's just interesting, like shared responsibility is well documented, but I think people still tend to lean on like, doesn't Azure do this for me? And the answer is probably no, still.
So there's definitely some lack of understanding for what Azure is actually doing versus what would be done for you. So maybe another segue for anyone who's probably deploying or securing an application in AKS, what are some of the components that they would have access to that they can maybe put a security baseline for?
The control plane, or what was historically kind of called the master node, it's highly configurable. It's got tons of different things. A very important component of your cluster insecure or secure. Things like anonymous authorization, things like, I mean, leaving it open to the internet just in general, or just RBAC, like etcd is stored there with all of your key value sort of pairs and your configuration data. So Azure is going to host that for you. They're going to take your control plane and surface some of that configuration for you to turn off or on. Some of it's security related, other things are not. And they are on the hook for your control plane. Same with EKS, AKS, et cetera. What that means is you are off the hook for a lot of the security kind of things that they don't surface. They're going to try to pick the most secure path, which is, I think, why, you know, I've listened to episodes in the past about managed Kubernetes with guests you've had on. It's like, yeah, if you can, you should use managed Kubernetes. Like, why would you not want that? But where things get a little more interesting are the workloads themselves. And I think I am tied into RBAC in general. Like, access control in Kubernetes is not a Azure AKS concern. You're kind of given the standard APIs available for RBAC. Your authentication is what you make of it. So it's not like you have one path and you're pushed into use in AKS. So that's an area where people have ultimate flexibility, but also is highly insecure in a lot of implementations. And networking is the same. It's like Kubernetes by default, kind of open. It's a flat network within the same cluster. So are you going to bring your own service mesh? Are you going to use the built-in? AKS has open service mesh, the project baked in, if you so choose to turn it on. So that's kind of cool. Like, if you want a service mesh, and Istio and GKE are the same sort of combo here, but open service mesh is a kind of click button sort of configuration you can turn on inside of your AKS environment. Same with Calico. If you want to use pure Kubernetes network policies, Calico is a first-class citizen, if you will, inside of AKS, and you can turn it on and you can have the ability to create network policies. And that's all great. I think using AKS is like, that's a huge benefit. Like, because most people don't need to go through a bake-off of their service mesh. They usually need like MTLS or some other thing or tracing, and they just want to pick a service mesh that works and isn't a headache. And I like that AKS offers one, and it's an open standard.
It's actually pretty awesome that this is a lot of things being given, almost to your point, as first-class citizens in the Azure environment itself. So it makes sense to go down the manage Azure Kubernetes path if they can. In terms of the monitoring side of things as well, then, because I'm assuming, you did the RBAC. How would you scale this? Okay, there seems to be a lot of things that are covered by them, but that's great for one cluster. But when I have multiple clusters of Azure AKS, does that same apply? Or at that point, I can just still rely on the Azure tooling by itself just to manage security across it?
Yeah, so there's a cool project in Azure. It's just called Azure Policy. So Azure Policies, there's a plugin for AKS that will let you run Azure Policy. I'm putting this in quotes on video, but it's really open policy agent with Gatekeeper. It's OPA, which is a great kind of rules engine, if you will, and Rego policies are all over the place, and it's a good DSL to be writing these sort of policies in. So Azure Policy, the plugin for AKS is like, again, the first class citizen, you can just kind of toggle the switch, you get policies, and Azure gives you a big old list that the top 20 things, here's some stuff you could turn on, insecure images, like disallowed workload configurations. There's all sorts of things that you would imagine because it's Gatekeeper under the hood, which is a very popular project that kind of maintains a great list of these configuration checks. And Azure is going to give you that. So like, a lot of our customers don't want to spin up Open Policy Agent and Gatekeeper per cluster and kind of manage their rules. And it's just this big mess of open source for big, we're talking 50 plus clusters. This is kind of a nice way, if you're just using Azure, like that's the caveat. Like, if you are using multi-cloud, this breaks down. But if you're just using Azure AKS, that's a great start. And you can write your own policies. So like, that's a pretty cool addition. And to your point with multi-cluster, like service mesh, has a story here. It's kind of weak still, like workload identity is hard. I think the promise of service mesh was always like everything's part of it. It's all one unified control plane. Like you can have a pod over here, a virtual machine over here, and it all will kind of be under the same umbrella in the service mesh. We have yet to see that. I don't see a lot of that happening, like, to be honest. Right. So I think for multi-cluster in Azure, you would have to rely on cloud network security fundamentals. Like, right. Are you in the VPC? Are these network policies sane? Do you have like site-to-site VPN style things that allow clusters to talk to one another? Do you have public clusters and private clusters? And you're more in the traditional network, like cloud security realm there than just pure Kubernetes. So, but yeah, I think there's some cool stuff that Azure offers that people maybe don't take as much advantage of as they should. So,
and if we kind of go down the networking path as well, then things like if your application requires a mutual TLS may not be a requirement at that point because you're using the Azure Fabric. Would that be?
It depends who's requiring MTLS. If it could be application based, we oftentimes the MTLS requirement comes from people or auditors specifically who don't necessarily have all the context of where this will live. So we see Istio used a lot for its MTLS capabilities because you have the Envoy sidecar sitting inside of the pod and it's doing all the, you know, the MTLS work, the heavy lifting there. And Open Service Mesh does that for you inside of AKS as well. I don't know if like what Azure offers out of the box with like their Azure Service Fabric, as you mentioned, has enough to say it's MTLS. I can't speak to that specifically.
Yeah, one of the things that I get always amazed by is the amount of adoption Kubernetes has had. Because I think we're talking about securing Kubernetes as well, but a lot of people may also be wondering, that's great, but I'm not going to put myself in a cube state where I'm in AKS. I wonder if you have some information on why Kubernetes became that two-part documentary kind of a thing. Why do you feel it stands out? Because I mean, a lot of people may be listening to this and going, "Well, I've got containers. I'm good. I don't need to go my application move to this Azure Kubernetes service or whatever." And not that we're trying to sell the idea that hey, you should use Azure Kubernetes service. Kubernetes by itself is a good thing, in my opinion. But I'm curious to know what's your opinion on why Kubernetes projects seems to get popular.
I think that managed Kubernetes there was like the first wave, like early adopters who are just like, I find this to be really interesting and cool. And I think there's a future here and early. Like that was a thing. And we didn't really have managed Kubernetes. So you were building your own clusters and COPS and even Terraform. And there's like other like recipes that would help you. But at the end of the day, like you're doing it yourself, like Kelsey Hightower style, the hard way. And I think that was like the first wave. But then in conjunction, the Kubernetes project was like very popular. Like people wanted to work on it. It was like a textbook open source project. I think it had its ups and downs, I'm sure. But like it was a popular high impact project to be working on in open source land, and companies started sponsoring it. And then I think the second wave, the real like the secondary rocket booster for Kubernetes was the introduction of EKS, GKE, and AKS. Because once you make it easy and you tightly couple things with other cloud components, like, oh, I can talk to KMS or this RDS database, or I can plug in these other systems I have already running in Azure. But now I just have this Kubernetes piece, and containers clearly are useful. Like developers like, well, maybe they don't like them, but they're a good way to deploy software. They have their pros and cons. But I think the developer tooling for containers got better over time. And then you introduce managed Kubernetes, and then all of a sudden, all the recipe for like destroying any other competition in the container orchestration space, it just nothing came close, really. Like ECS even is in AWS is a lot of people we talk to anecdotally, like they're trying to get off of ECS and move to EKS because there's just not the ecosystem around ECS. It's very proprietary. It's very Amazon-y. It's not an open project really. So all that stuff together.
And Kubernetes is basically irrespective of whichever cloud you end up going. I mean, we're talking about AKS, but if it's GKE or your EKS or whatever, they would all kind of have a very similar way of your Kubernetes components would not dramatically change, no matter which cloud you go for. Around it may change, like, oh, you're talking about Azure commands versus AWS commands, but the Kubernetes fabric itself doesn't really change. It's literally, to what they said, cloud agnostic.
That's the hope. I mean,
that's the hope.
I think it's hard to be completely cloud agnostic, even if you're using Kubernetes. If you're using managed Kubernetes, you're not really using the pure, you're not like forking or cloning the project and running Kubernetes. Like, you're using Azure's implementation of Kubernetes. And at KSOC, our company, we use Kubernetes, and our whole goal is to keep it as agnostic as possible so we can run on-prem or run in other places, like inside of a Kubernetes. Like, and it's not easy. You have to make very specific decisions that keep you in Kubernetes and not take advantage of what Azure has to offer or AWS. It's pretty tough.
Oh, and also because that you've made an active choice for being purely Kubernetes as well. Because I mean, imagine in an enterprise where you're not the only person making a decision. It seems to be a lot more people or too many chefs in the same in the kitchen. It would be hard to kind of continue making decisions for we're going to be purely Kubernetes to make it purely cloud agnostic. Because there would be compromises made here and there.
It's tough because it's way easier to be tied to your cloud. These security examples, it's like, I need a service mesh. I can either click a button in AKS and have it, or I can like roll my own and run Istio or Linkerd. And that's a journey that I'm going to have to take. And I'm not sure, like, you have to weigh those pros and cons. Secrets management, like, to have secrets management be tied to like KMS or something your cloud provides, and they just plug into it, your Kubernetes, that's pretty slick. I like that. And the other option is like, don't use that. I have to use Vault or something in the cluster or some generic thing. And it's always easier to choose what your cloud provides from.
Or even identity for that matter as well. Like, you have your enterprise identity, your cloud identity, and whatever other identity you want as well.
Identity, it can be so tied to your cloud. IAM is like everything inside of AWS and like, you know, Azure Active Directory and AKS, like tightly coupled. And that's generally a good thing until you need to be kind of more agnostic. And RBAC is a whole nother topic inside of Kubernetes I'm really interested in. It's a mess and we have a lot of work to do there.
Kubernetes probably is popular because of the opportunity people have to kind of the whole orchestration scale kind of a thing with containers, and has a huge community backing behind it. We've also learned from you as to what are some of the components you probably look out for to secure it, and what are some of the components that are shared by Azure as well. When it comes to monitoring, what are we really looking out for then? What does the cloud provider take care of? I'm assuming some kind of a Azure Sentinel integration somewhere, or some kind of a...
That's exactly it, yeah.
Oh, that's it.
Well, I mean, yeah, Azure Sentinel and Azure DevOps is going to provide a lot of the CI, CD pieces. Like, we have a customer that uses Azure Git or Azure Code. I forget what it's called, but they're Git hosting, right? They only use GitHub. It's like all Azure all the time. And from like the code through the DevOps pipeline, through the many, many AKS clusters, and off the back end, all the logging, monitoring, alerting, like all that stuff is native to Azure. So, I mean, the product aside, Kubernetes generates a variety of logs, like in this, like they're not just OS system level logs that we're caring about. There's actually built in AKS, like it is part of, I think it's part of the Sentinel suite, and some like filters and things, like a thing you can buy additionally to look for in their AKS specific security events. So they look for things. You're taking in the Kubernetes API audit log under the hood, and you're looking for anomalies or events that make you scratch your head and want to look in more. So things like Jimmy's logging into this AKS cluster at midnight, trying to list secrets in the Kube system namespace, and he's failing, but he keeps trying it. Like, that's the natural language of saying it, but like, you can find that through Kubernetes logs. Is it easy to find? No, but they're there. And those audit logs are really powerful. They all oftentimes go to like DevNull and they aren't really looked at, but they're telling a story. Like this service account token is accessing some sort of workload over here. It's never done that before. We don't even use service account tokens in that way. That's another story that's good to tell as well. And I think we're going to see a lot of innovation in the anomaly detection of those Kubernetes specific logs in the next year or two. It's just natural. So, and Azure has all that stuff. Like you can go through it. Another reason to use managed Kubernetes, like if you choose not to, again, you have to send a configuration to the Kubernetes API, pick the audit logs you want, give them a place to go, store them, like it, all the things. And you're just like, I'm just going to use my cloud provider.
I think the team skills are required for this as well. How many people out there would have learned? I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of people because Kubernetes is a big community, but how many are in your state or probably are working in your team who can probably have that skill set to do Kubernetes from scratch? Like, not manage one, and then they leave after a month and you're like, well, what do I do now?
Yeah, I don't know. I think unless you need it, and some implementations do, like we're hearing about Kubernetes running in fighter jets, or You're hearing about Kubernetes powering like cruise liners. There's a guy I was talking to who worked for the government for a long time, and they had Kubernetes nodes that were fake rocks that they would plant in the deserts in like kind of high conflict areas. And each Kubernetes node was a rock, and it like had temperature sensors and cameras and like that. You're going to roll your own Kubernetes if you're doing that. Like that, you're not really appropriate use of AKS. If you're doing like a CRUD SaaS application, like you absolutely should consider managed Kubernetes. There's really no reason, unless I don't know, like there's no reason to be doing your own Kubernetes in that sort of capacity, in my opinion. So others would disagree, I'm sure.
I'm with you on that one. Why not take the easy route and not recreate the wheel? One of the major reasons for people to go down the managed path was just the whole team skill set as well. Like once you lose that one person who's basically devoted their 4 or 5 years into learning Kubernetes from scratch, they build the whole self-hosted one, and then they got a better offer from Google or wherever, and they leave, and you're like, who's going to look after this? There is no amount of knowledge sharing you can do to transfer all that knowledge onto another person. It's just not practical. Whereas if you kind of go down the managed path, at least you have some hope that, there'll be documentation. There's documentation otherwise as well, but at least there would be things that you can get help with, and there'd be a lot more known sequences to this as well. At least that's my thinking. Yeah. What do you
think? I think you can reverse engineer a managed Kubernetes environment and figure out how you got from point A to point B. Probably. Yep. If you're doing your own stuff and like you have these like very special snowflake nodes over here that are GPU intensive, and like these other nodes aren't like tolerated for this thing, and our API has like some boutique setup that isn't checked in as code, like you're just dealing with like an old crusty VM that can't go down, and that's not the point of Kubernetes. So I think if you're really big, like some FANG style size companies will like run their own paths and like probably in their own data center for money and like saving opportunities. And at that point, like you might have a team of 50 who are responsible for Kubernetes. Like that's a different story than the average software company that's like, I just need to ship product and I don't care about any of the stuff you're talking about. It's like Heroku versus AWS. It's like people like Heroku still. And they should.
Yeah, 100%. And maybe that's a good segue into the whole thing about securing it as well. Maybe what's the maturity scale? I kind of always come back to this where people listening to this may be going, okay, cool. So I am sold on the idea of going AKS. What's the scale that I'm going building up with? So if I'm a startup today, these are at least the minimum things I should think about from securing AKS. And then you kind of go on from becoming, I don't know, the next Facebook or whatever. What do you see as the next sequence of security best practices they could apply starting from today on their startup and then growing all the way to a Facebook kind of a level?
So Kubernetes as a project is mature. I mean, I don't think that's a hot take. If you read the release notes, we're getting fancy security features still kind of baked in, but like the core is mature. Azure as a public cloud, yes, there are very high profile breaches that are happening. There's no denying that, like, the research that's going after Azure specifically, like, there's problems under the hood of Azure. Yeah. That's fine. But I would still rank managed Kubernetes across all three clouds as more mature than not. And then it's like, where things get very fuzzy is like, what's your maturity of how you use Kubernetes in AKS specifically? And that can range from a 1 to a 10. It's like, you could use everything that's possible to make that cluster like battle hardened, or you could do nothing or actually detract from your security. So the things that I think enterprises face as they scale, number one is simple. I just call it cluster sprawl. Like, there's this whole problem that we see very frequently where you ask the chief security architect at major company XYZ that's been there a year, and you're like, where are your clusters? And the answer is like, I don't know. And it's like, we don't even know what cloud they're in sometimes, yet alone if they're all AKS clusters. So like, number one is maintaining consistency across clusters, because one AKS profile is different than another AKS profile. There's different versions and configurations. The logs could be turned off for one and turned on for another. So there's consistency issues that are just hard to deal with at scale. So reining that in is really important, asset inventory stuff. And then number two is like, you should be using a distributed policy mechanism, whether it's the Azure policies that you could turn on that are backed by OPA and kind of gatekeeper, or you're doing something more multi-cloud friendly, hybrid cloud friendly. You need to build a baseline of policies for workloads and clusters that is repeatable. Like, you just have to, because workloads are going to vary. They're going to come from different teams, different places, and everybody needs to follow some conformance. This is where CIS benchmarks and the NSA hardening guidelines and the newer kind of publications around, like, this is bad and this is good. And I think you have to get a grip on that pretty early, because going backwards after you already have 50 clusters is hard. And then secrets management, like a hot topic. And I think Kubernetes doesn't make it easier. So whatever you choose, again, consistency is key. Like, you have a policy. You don't throw secrets into the Kubernetes secrets object that are base64 encoded, and you don't, like, maybe you have to use KMS or Vault or some sort of thing that your company's agreed to. And I'll take this moment to plug some lesser known Kubernetes security resources that I enjoy. I mean, I may or may not have helped write some of them, but still, there's OWASP Kubernetes Security Cheat Sheet. It's really good. And I worked on it with some awesome, smart people. It gets used by OWASP folks, but not other people.
I wasn't even aware OWASP has a project in Kubernetes.
And on that note, I'm working with a group of people on the OWASP top 10 for Kubernetes. So if you've ever done AppSec, that there's like the OWASP top 10, the big kind of top 10 That's project. Right. And we're doing one for Kubernetes specifically. Yep. And it's kind of the stuff we talked about. And we're definitely looking for people to help with that effort. It's a huge effort. And in like a month, we'll have kind of the draft out there for people to put comments on and help make better. So those are two cool things. And I maintain a Kubernetes security awesome list on GitHub that the community has a lot of people contributing to. They're important because those are the challenges that we see people facing as they go from like, we're trying Kubernetes out in this Skunkworks project. Oh no, like, we have 7 clusters. Uh-oh, we've decided to use it in this machine learning thing over here. Now we have 13 clusters. And a year later, you're not really sure what's happening. You're kind of just like the classic, like, dog in the flames with a cup of coffee meme. Like, I have no idea. Everything's fine. And you have to go back and figure it out.
What are some of the challenges at scale that you see people do this? Because, I mean, clearly asset management is one where they don't have an idea about their cluster, where the cluster is, and what they might be up to. and the other one being having just a distributed policy. Sounds like those are the two big themes that I took away from that conversation that we just had.
Yeah. In our back, you should be thinking deeply about who's accessing a cluster. Like kube control is like the new SSH. And is it appropriate for everybody to be SSHing to every box in your entire public cloud? Probably not. There's just a lot of attack surface there, to be honest, like with giving humans and service accounts access to Kubernetes. The control plane is very granular. And if you get your group wrong, or you give somebody too many permissions, the ramifications can be like huge. So I think that's another big picture thing as you grow is like, what's our story around RBAC? How are we segmenting and slicing up this kind of multi-tenant environment? Is it through namespaces? Is it clusters? Like you have to have design decisions and discussions that are with access control in mind and identity and monitoring of that identity.
And out of curiosity, where does one learn about all this, man? Because I feel like it needs to be, I obviously we have the resources for Kubernetes security cheat sheet, the Azure specific ones as well. Is there a resource that you recommend for people to learn Kubernetes, AKS, and maybe even the whole managed Kubernetes space on how to secure them?
Yeah, I think the CIS benchmarks, as not as imperfect as the any benchmark may be, is going to give you the rundown of what's going on. The NSA hardening guidelines really good. It's less prescriptive. It's more of like a categories of things with fixes. Other than that, it's like KubeCon talks. Like I don't know. Like it's really interesting. There's not like there's a lot of different places to go to get bits and pieces, but it is pretty tough to have a comprehensive view into like general Kubernetes security, because AKS security could be its own 2-day course. Like that's just, it's a data center inside your data center. So like it's a lot of things to tackle. I have given lots of trainings through the past 4 years. I've been doing like tons of like trainings in the open. We built a really cool kind of CTF for KubeCon 2019 that is published. Nice. It's at securekubernetes.com. It's maintained myself, Brad Giesman, Tabby Sable, and Peter Benjamin. And it was super fun. But that's what you got to do. You have to like crack this thing open and take one concept at a time, like network policies. Start there, maybe. Like, what is networking in Kubernetes? Like, how does it work? Why do I need a network policy? What's like a networking plugin even do? And why, like, how do you route traffic from point A to point B? And then how do you like scope it down? Like that's, you have to pick big kind of these topics and dive in. So
sweet.
Or you just cool. Hit me up, like hit me up on Twitter or wherever. And I'll hopefully point you in directions and share cool stuff.
Sure. And I'll definitely leave a link there as well. So that's kind of like the technical section of the podcast. And thank you for kind of answering all those questions as well. We're kind of like the tail end, which is the fun question side. I've got three questions for you. So non-technical, okay. Just to get to know you a bit. The first one being, what do you spend most time on when you're not working on Kubernetes or technology?
Yeah, I have two boys, 2 and 4. So one can imagine they're my life with both my family and my wife. And we, for fun, we live up in the mountains of Flagstaff, Arizona, and I mountain bike. And my whole family mountain bikes. I've grew up on, I'm probably better on a bike than my feet, to be honest. So I spend a lot of time in the saddle, throw myself down steep chutes and cliffs and things. So I really like that.
Nice.
And yeah, other than that, hanging with the family, getting outside.
Awesome. And what is something that you're proud of, but is not on your social media?
Oh man. I don't share too much on social media about my private life. So there's probably a lot, but when I was 12, I was ranked number one in the US for my age and category in BMX racing. So that's
really
a little lesser known fact. Then I broke my back. I still got like 13, and I had a little kid career in BMX racing, nothing serious.
Well, so you could have been like one of those Red Bull sponsored athletes and stuff as well.
That I was very far from that, but I've always aspired to that. And there's a lot of trophies from back in the day. So now it's just about getting outside. And
that's awesome. Last question. What's your favorite cuisine or restaurant that you can share?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned you before this, like I'm down at my mother-in-law's place and she's a great cook. Like I can't deny everything that she makes is like mind-boggling. I love it. If I'm going to go out somewhere, I think there's, I tend to gravitate towards hipster seeming restaurants, like fusions of certain things, small portions, but really just unique food. It doesn't really matter the region, but I like that. And then I love international travel. Like we talked about this too. Like when I'm somewhere, I want to like totally immerse myself and eat everything I can. Like I've been to Taiwan a few times and done all the food stalls and all the anything crazy I could get my hands on.
Wait, so you had the ants and everything?
It was like a jelly lollipop thing from a stand that had some sort of bugs in it. I don't remember what bugs they were for sure. Yeah.
Well, you're alive. So.
Yeah, they are. I have regretted those decisions before, but I'll still do them. So, yeah.
Fair enough. Now, that's pretty much what we had time for. But where can people find you if they have more questions about the space and want to learn about securing Kubernetes in cloud or managed Kubernetes as well?
Yeah. So Jim Mesta on Twitter is fine. Like we're building tools around it at KSOC, ksoc.com. We have a blog and some things there. YouTube, I don't know, pretty easy to find.
I'll put the links in the show notes as well so people can actually easily find you as well. But dude, cool. Thanks so much for doing this, man. I really appreciate this. And thank you for everyone who came online. But this is really good because I think I haven't covered Azure Kubernetes security, and it was good to kind of dive into a bit more nuance for what's covered, what's not covered. So thank you so much for doing this, and hopefully I can have you again for more Kubernetes stuff, man. Maybe next time we can do AWS Kubernetes.
There we go. We'll do all three. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. And anytime. It's been awesome. Long time listener, and honored to be here. So thanks for having me.
No problem, Jimmy. Thanks so much. And thank you, everyone else, as well. We'll see you in the next episode. And I'll hopefully have Jimmy back soon as well. All right, thanks, everyone. Talk to you soon. See ya. Thank you for listening to that episode of Cloud Security Podcast. If you found some new information from that episode, we would appreciate if you share it with others. Share it with us as well if you have any good feedback or good learnings from the episode. We are on all your favorite podcast platforms. If you don't find us there, you can always go on our website, www.cloudsecuritypodcast.tv, to listen to the latest episode. We appreciate your support in helping us grow. It helps us bring more guests. It helps us support the channel. So really appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time, and talk to you on the next episode.